You are listening to Microchurches, a podcast for missionaries and leaders living out their God-given calling through this small expression of the church. This podcast is meant to encourage, equip, and contribute to the overall discussion of this smaller way. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy. You are listening to Microchurches, a podcast for people brave enough to be small. This is your host, Tommy Wilkerson, and in this season, we are talking to microchurch leaders and network leaders all around the world about what they're learning as they go about microchurch life and journeying with microchurch leaders. But a feature of this season is talking with who I consider world-class subject matter experts on things maybe pertaining to microchurches, even if it's not directly about microchurches, but just helpful things for microchurches and microchurch leaders to consider. And so this is part two of my conversation with John and Taylor about Brave Cities and Kingdom ecosystems and what that means for microchurches. And so I'm super excited. I mean, these guys are some of my absolute heroes, just getting the chance to pick their brains. I always walk away feeling more inspired to be a better Christian than I was before talking to these guys. And so I'm so glad to have them back. And I want to pick up where we left off. So our last episode, we kind of ended by sort of teasing out the question of what does it look like for microchurches to consider themselves or to be part of some sort of kingdom ecosystem. And there was a handful of things that we touched on in that, whether that was, you know, kind of evaluating the needs of the city, kind of pulling back from the things that we're tempted to normally do, like programming as usual. There was a way of like shifting our thinking from just like a consumerist space to setting tables for people and facilitating relationship. And so I guess what I want to do in that this episode is dive on that, touch on that a little bit more to the extent that we can. But I would love to also get into your stories or things that you all have learned as you've gone about building these kingdom ecosystems in your respective cities. And so I guess maybe a good place as any is just for a recap for people who are listening to this. I highly recommend you go back to part one and listen to that. But for people who are just sort of diving into this episode, just a quick refresher. How are we talking about defining kingdom ecosystems? What does that mean for our listener?
All right, you just said a lot there. I'm processing it all, mainly that me and John make you a better Christian. I thought that was
great. It's the first time I ever heard
anyone. Yeah. I just want that to be my
that should be the title.
Better Christian maker. Thank you, Tommy.
I'll put that on my phone.
John, you don't always make me a better Christian.
I know.
But sometimes you do. Yeah, I mean, the thing that we like to say all the time is we're building a better city within our city. And that building is so nuanced because as we've journeyed for almost 15 years now, or kind of, worked, really, we found that we have to find the right language to help us not lose our way in the work. So like first we start with this idea from Revelation 18 of coming out of Babylon. Fallen is Babylon the Great, Babylon is empire. Babylon is, you know, a lot of times we read the term the world or the world system. Babylon is the opposite of kingdom. So to come out of her has really been the effort. What does that look like to come out and to quote unquote build a better city? Well, first we've landed real solidly on the idea that we don't build the kingdom; we uncover it. There's no real mandate that you can find throughout history, church history, or I mean, maybe we said it, but biblical history of go and build the kingdom. But we know we do build. We know we work with our hands. We know we create. We know construct. But we want to understand why and what we're to construct. So maybe we talked about this in our previous episode, but an idea that we throw out there a lot is the process of archaeology, artistry, and architecture. Mm. So did we talk about that last time, Tomi?
I believe so.
Yeah. So in the archaeology phase, man, we're just uncovering the kingdom in our context. We're trying to find like what it's been doing for centuries before us, where it is, what's covered it up. How can we chisel away the evil? So the kingdom ecosystem, since we've already talked about that, I'll just say the kingdom ecosystem is the city that's being uncovered and the tables that are being architected within that. They're interconnected. They are decentralized, but an important distinguishing idea is that they're also distributed. And that's the idea of the church, is we are all kind of interconnected and open to distribution in and amongst ourselves, locally, globally, wherever, fighting viciously against this idea of competition within a kind of Christian industrial complex, fighting viciously against this idea of mine is bigger than yours, mine is better than yours, mine is more contextual or relevant or has a better experience than yours. Everything in our geographical context, the hope is that it would be not just interconnected, not just decentralized, but also distributed. How can we work together, help one another? That looks like restaurants and businesses and creative spaces, co-working spaces. That looks like blue collar work, like construction or landscaping or bike repair. That looks like artistic work, like graphic design, painting, music studios. And that looks like worship experiences, sacraments, kind of historical, you know, liturgical connection, vertical connections to what we think of when we think of worship. All of those things functioning as tables within the kingdom ecosystem to then connect seekers to the hope of Jesus, to the story of Jesus, which is so much broader, if you will, than you send, you need a bridge to get to God. Jesus became that bridge. Believe in him and you'll be saved. That is one of the, if not the best part of the story, but it's just part of the story. The story is so much broader than that, of what Jesus came to tell and came to say. So that's the kingdom ecosystem. It is not a new thought. It's anybody who's listening to this and knows an ounce of church history knows that it's the most ancient of all kind of church planting or church cultivating thoughts. But it is quite prophetic, I believe, in our day and fighting, like I said, actively and viciously against the kind of church as we know it, modern Christian industrial complex culture.
Anything you want to chime in, John?
So I would just say that, you know, using the image of setting tables, there's tables that get set, and how we set those tables really matters. And so, you know, part of the work of trying to set tables for, let's say, kingdom to emerge, one of the very simple ways I've heard this said is like just creating places where it's easier for people to be good. And so one of the ways this was driven home for me, you know, we've done a lot with the homeless over the years, and we ran a lot of like meal sites, places for people to come and get dinner. And when we first started that, it was ugly. You know, we get food from Metro, this big box ministry that would give us Cambros full of food. And we have a building with fluorescent lights and plastic tables and styrofoam plates and, you know, plastic forks and some Kool-Aid or water or something. And you know, you deal with a lot of mental health and drug addiction and all this stuff. And they would come in, and inevitably, almost every single week when we did it, there would be a fight. There would be chaos. There would be something we'd have to deal with. Right. And then we got some people to sponsor that night, and we got tablecloths and centerpieces and a dishwasher and glass goblets and plates and real silverware, cloth napkins, pitchers of water on the table, put a maitre d' at the door. We killed the fluorescent lights and hung Christmas lights throughout the room, lit candles, and had a person playing guitar or violin or something, some instrument during the meal. And the exact same people that we saw every week became almost romantic, you know, please pass the pepper. Like the environment really did impact and transform the like lived reality and the behavior of the actual individuals that we knew for all that time. Mm. And that's when I was like, oh, we're environmentalists. And I always thought about this, the parable of the mustard seed, like there's a little seed and you plant it, it grows in this great tree. But then there's this piece in that parable that Jesus said, like birds came and perch in its branches, and always just baffled me. Like, what the hell like is that? Like it became a home. Right. Mm-hmm. And then birds, like, what do? They poop, and then they poop and they make the ground more fertile. And I just picture this entire ecosystem emerging out of this like seed that was planted. And in the very real way that we understand ecosystem as organic and naturally occurring and not in under your control and not something that, but something you can maybe co-collaborate with or co-create with, but that you don't have mastery over or totally define because it is occurring of its own accord. I think that's kind of a thing that I've witnessed that I would say is, you know it when you see it, right? The kingdom. And you want to continue to hone your ability to set tables where it's easier for people to be good and neighborly and loving and Christ-like and encounter God and one another and learn from one another and hear one another across, let's say, racial lines, economic lines, things that normally divide us. We want to set tables that bring folks together around those. And like Taylor said, sometimes that looks like a bike shop or a bike ride. Sometimes that looks like a community garden. Sometimes that looks like a dinner table or even a Bible study. But it's all of those are just tables that you set, opportunities to bring folks together around those, like for those purposes. And and if any of those don't serve that purpose, it's disposable in some way, compostable, and see if we can't move those things into something else in kind of an ecological pursuit.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, the ever evolving concept is necessary in this kingdom ecosystem conversation. I think that it's another challenging idea to the current model of the way of Jesus that we have. The reality is none of these tables should be golden calves. None of them should exist as kind of a staple or standard of biblical obedience. For almost a decade, when people knew that we didn't have a sitting in rows Sunday 10 a.m. to 11:15 a.m. worship service, for almost a decade, I was asked regularly, aren't you forsaking the assembling then? And it always genuinely, like without sarcasm and without kind of spite, it always blew my mind that the human mind had become so conditioned, especially the Western mind, to make synonymous or parallel assembly, the word assembling, with this paradigm of unless you're driving with a car full of screaming kids or your college girlfriend or your roommates or, you know, your parents to this space that is set up and designed in this certain way for you to walk in, be greeted, countdown on the screen, music in the background, sit down in rows or at tables if you're really edgy, and then be talked to for 45 minutes, sung to for 45 minutes, then you've forsaken the assembly. Here's the mind-blowing part of it for people when I tell them this. All that is fine. There is nothing inherently or biblically wrong about that process. There's nothing wrong with doing it high church, liturgical, cold, stale, you know, hymns and organ. There's nothing wrong with black box lights, trusses, worship team that just looks amazing with tattoos on their forearms, and plays great music, incredible speaker. There's nothing wrong with any of the models that are virtually the exact same thing we've been doing for over 500 years. What happened is somewhere along the way, we determined that that was church and that was the table that cannot change and cannot really evolve at all. When we think of evolution of that service, we're really thinking of microevolution because nothing has changed in that hour experience with God in well over 500 years. So what John is saying is that these tables are always evolving. They're always moving, and look, the ones who are architecting the tables or building the tables, or the workers who are working at the tables, they're always looking at them saying, are we creating places for people to do good? Are we forging discipleship in this space? You know, I was reading about sword making one time. I don't know when, but maybe you guys know this. First, let me set the table and then I'll land the plane by saying this. Living in empire, you know, let me just look back to Revelation 18 for a second, come out of her. Living in empire, we all feel this kind of drawing to the things of the world, right? That's obvious. That's not a mystery. We feel like, man, I want money. I want prestige. I want security. I want stability, whatever we would call. I want sex. I want women. I want men. I want alluring things. I want possessions, you know, to hoard myself with possessions, whatever. We feel that drawing. I was reading about sword making because that crucible or that forging process is really interesting to me. And it says that, I'm curious if y'all know this, because I know this has been in y'all's language before. Do you know what the training is to heat the metal to so that you can forge a sword properly? It says that you're to heat it to non-magnetic metal, which is at about 1420 or 1820 degrees. So you heat the metal so much, you place it in a crucible or in a forging process so hot that it becomes non-magnetic, that then it's pliable, but then it also becomes stronger to wear and more significantly resilient to, you know, outside sources. So all of this is to say, if you're still tracking with me, that we're forming tables and architecting tables that the Spirit of God is leading us to, so that we can create spaces that makes it easier to do good. For some, that space is just simply a place to come and hear Tommy or Taylor or John talk. They just need a word from us. They need to hear us say, like, God loves you and you're not just cut off from him. There's hope in him. But for some, man, over time, that's got to shift. That table needs to become hotter. It needs to become more intense. It needs to burn away that magnetism. It needs to burn away that, what's it called? That dross, you know? So the table is ever evolving. And when any table becomes a golden calf that we're like, that's the one we can't get rid of, that's usually the one that needs to be gotten rid of.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I want to get into maybe what that looks like in your context, respective context, because I think there's a way that, you know, I'm hearing you talk about it. And I guess there's one way that people can hear this and be like, oh, so like a Christian coffee shop, which maybe is a good example of that, right? Like, all right, there's a coffee shop that's owned by Christians. They maybe have like an open mic night. They do little, you know, Bible studies occasionally out of this coffee shop. And so it's not like entirely unfamiliar, but there's a way in which I hear you speaking about kingdom ecosystems that feels like, yes, and it's bigger than that. And it's more than that. It's more expansive than that. Like, that's a piece of it, but it's not the entirety of it. And so I'd be curious to hear about what these ecosystems look like in your respective cities.
Let me just say before John talks that the term Christian is virtually irrelevant. Everything is Christian. Everything is sacred, if that's what we mean by Christian. It's all from God. You know, we learn this when we learn about music, when we finally start to break free from this idea of like only Christian music. We start to realize and understand in our spirits that all mute. Why is it that that Michael Jackson song, or why is it that that Wu-Tang song did something in my heart that's similar to that Hillsong song or that Bethel song? Sure, we could say we could get in the debate of like lyrics and all that. That's not the point. The point is that all music is sacred. All expression is sacred. All of it comes from God in some way, shape, or form, even if it's been twisted, right? So I just wanted to set John up by saying, like, yeah, there's almost told me as if there's no such thing as a Christian coffee shop or a Christian bike shop, because it's all sacred. All the work within the kingdom ecosystem architecture is sacred, and for the sake of good news.
You know, it's funny as you said that, because I was also having a little bit of a reaction, and I wanted to the idea of the Christian coffee shop, and I think it's worth teasing out a little bit. So I don't know if it's an idiosyncrasy to me. It doesn't feel like it, and him saying that makes me wonder. So what I would say is, a fundamental principle, let's say the most commonly repeated, the most repeated charge in all of scripture is to welcome the stranger. And by the way, the stranger, you guys, you know, that Greek word is xenos. And like, we know that word because of like, it gets thrown around as xenophobia, like afraid of the other, right? And hospitality throughout the New Testament is actually xenophilia. It's the love of the other. And I would say, the welcoming of the stranger, the other, is the one. It's like, this is the great, this is like a great commandment, I would say. This is like the heart of the teachings of Jesus. Is like the alien, the outcast, the prisoner, the poor, but also like the stranger, like the one that just isn't like you. Politically, ethnically, whatever. So all of that is a setup to say, whatever space we set up, if we are trying to set that space as followers of Jesus, as kingdom, as possible for the kingdom to emerge as could happen, I would say that hospitality has to be at the top of the list of values. Why I'm saying that is, that I would argue is what makes a space Christian, is that it is welcoming. And if a Christian coffee shop puts Bible verses on the walls and has Bible studies in there and puts what I would call a lot of Christian propaganda around the building, what that does is it works as propaganda. Like, these are the things we care about, rather than those things being known by the embodiment of them. It's like propaganda of them. So I feel like it's cheap and cheating in a way. So I'm like, hey, don't give yourself the freedom to do that. But also think about the person that you're trying to welcome into your space. Is that, and it being someone that isn't a Christian, isn't a follower of Jesus, isn't like, do you want to welcome the stranger, the other, into your space, your living room, your coffee shop, your bike shop, your pub, your barber shop? There is no such thing as a Christian barber shop. There's just a Christian who is a barber, who runs a barber shop, who fleshes out that faith in love of other and neighbor, and engages in dialogue that is life-giving to those that he works with. And I would say that, like, there isn't Christian work. There's just work done to the glory of God, right? It can't be like titled that. And so I don't know. I know you're asking about like a practical thing, but I think this is a very practical thing. Like, I'm in the bike shop right now. And if you search this place, like Fine Tooth Comb, you will not find any cross or Bible verses or anything like that throughout the entire space. Like resolutely. It's not like by accident. It's like, no, we're not doing that in here. There is one clue that is when you ask for our Wi-Fi password, it says it is love your neighbor. Is the only thing that might be like a breadcrumb, right, in the space. But it is by design. And you know what's interesting is folks that are Christian, that are believers, that have discernment, it's like they know it when they see it. They walk in and they go, yeah, we see y'all. But it's not because of our propaganda or our Christian t-shirts or our what's on the wall or, you know, those kinds of things. And so I do think, like, at a very practical way, is like the question is, how do you be about it rather than talk about it? Like, how can you actually exercise love of the other? And by the way, the thing that Taylor was saying before about those entities, like churches, that like, this is the thing that nothing can become a golden calf. I would actually say too, that like part of what it is to be a Christian is to be willing to lay down your life, which I think is directly connected to welcoming the stranger, because strangers can be, it's unknown, it's dangerous. It's like they bring pestilence and like who knows what they bring, right? This is why, like, evolutionarily we have a fear of the other. Like that's there's good reason for that.
Yeah.
And so like that makes sense. And I do think the call of Christianity is like to be willing to lay down your life, and to welcome the stranger is in some way to lay down your life. But also, when anything we have is unwilling to lay down its life, that thing ceases to be Christian, I would argue. And the most horrifying versions of that is, like he was talking about before, things with tons of Christian propaganda all over them, but a complete posture of like Babylon and competitiveness and an unwillingness to die. Now, I don't want to get off on that tangent, but I do think it helps to like juxtapose a very practical conviction we have around like hospitality and loving of neighbor at just the core. Like that's what, and then it's like, yeah, be a barber, love your neighbor, run a coffee shop, love your neighbor.
Yeah.
Be a dentist, love your neighbor.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I think where the conversation has to be nuanced, and even maybe the paradigm has to be nuanced, is we're talking about more than just be a good dentist. And like John and I both are talking about more than just be a good dentist. We want dentists who love their neighbors. But we kind of fundamentally believe, I guess fundamentally, that word's a little triggering, but we deeply, passionately believe that where the righteous prosper, the city rejoices. Babylonian cities can never rejoice, or the powers that rule over Babylonian cities can never rejoice in righteousness. So what's rejoicing? The people are. The people are rejoicing that their city is becoming better. The people are rejoicing that peace is coming, and that the poor are. Look, when the poor are really, when they find a place at the table, the reason what happened with John and the banquet is so beautiful and so important to this conversation is all they did was they found a person of peace. That person of peace were tablecloths and goblets and a maitre d' and a musician. They brought peace to a room, and then peace, essentially shalom, flowed throughout the hearts of those who had become quite animalistic in their nature and their behavior. And that's really just a microcosm of what the kingdom city brings to a city. Where the city begins to rejoice because the things that are not peaceful begin to become peaceful.
And so what do these tables look like in your place? I know, John, you've mentioned the bike shop. You've mentioned maybe some of the, you know, dinners that you've hosted.
Yeah, I can rattle off a few things. I mean, we run a bike shop. It's called Web Oat Bikes. It's a nonprofit bike shop. We sell refurbished bikes, some new bikes. And then the way we've set it up is there's a lot of folks around here that cannot afford to meet their transportation needs. So if you can't afford to get a bike, like by purchasing it, though we have affordable bikes, we have an earn a bike program. So people that cannot afford to meet their transportation needs can get a bike through community service hours. So they invest time in, which actually turns out to be the better gift sometimes than the bike itself, working with us and alongside us, whether it's in our bike shop or in one of our community gardens or in one of our food distributions or one of the other things that we do. They work with us to earn their bike and they buy it with time, for which they've told us this is meaningful work for which we feel well compensated, which is like the best feedback imaginable. And then they get a bicycle, which in my mind, you know, you might remember your first bike. It's freedom. It's like you can go and do what you need to do on that bike. And people are able to meet a lot of their own more basic needs by getting that bike. And then we offer our services, our service department on sliding scale. So if you can't afford it, we'll just, what can you afford? We'll talk to you. We'll do that. We have some community gardens that people don't have work, don't have food. Let's work together to grow food. We use the garden and co-creation and love for creation as like a table to bring people together. We think the best way to build a relationship is in shoulder to shoulder work. So let's work together in the garden. We do the same thing with, we have a mobile grocery that we run 27 distributions a month right now. It's like a refrigerated unit we take around town. In fact, there's one on its way out right now. Actually in 15 minutes, they'll be setting up over at a park behind an elementary school right by here where they'll be distributing groceries. We do those 27 times a month in, those are all on repeat so that we see the same neighbors with the same community all the time to build relationships. We have a handful of other projects. We're dipping our toes into some real estate stuff. And we've got a little tech project that I don't know that we'll ever be able to like fully realize just out of like the absolute cost of development. That one's challenging. But there's lots of things we've got our hands in because there's a lot of work to be done to build a city, to build an economy that is targeted around those for whom our current economy is not working. That would be the like briefest way I would say that, why all these things. But yeah, there's like, then there's the thing itself. Like we do some stuff like bike shops and gardens and food and housing. And,
yeah.
And you'll notice they're all around basic needs. Like for us, those are all basic needs. And hopefully once we have those covered, we can evolve into some of the more, I would love and am jealous for, and I think Taylor should share, like one of the things that they've done really well that we have done somewhat, it's like kind of happening, is like the like social infrastructure side where you really built out like a solid, what do they call, like a third space for people to kind of hang, work like together. And so I'll let him just kind of jump in and like paint the picture of their ecosystem a little bit.
And one of the reasons, Tomi, that we always are, I don't know that it's that we're naturally hesitant to talk about the specifics of these tables. I think it's more that it doesn't really interest us because it's not, like, think of it this way. All right. If you can, maybe try to summarize your week last week, day to day, other than your normal everyday work. Like, let's say on a Thursday, you get up and you do what, Tomi?
I might go to the gym, depending on.
Okay, you go to the gym. Then what do you do? And you can be vague like that, just kind of on a natural day. After the gym, you what?
Yeah, come home, make breakfast. Oh, no, come home, have quiet time, make breakfast.
You go home. Let's say that evening. What do you do that evening? Do your kids do any sports yet?
Not yet. We need to put on something.
But your friend who lives near you, Lucas, his kid plays sports, right? Where do they go to play sports?
I know they have a league that they go to on Saturday or Sundays sometimes.
It's probably at like a community center or a sports complex, right?
Right.
Like a soccer field, right? What about like you and your wife, do you and Bree do anything? Restaurants, coffee shops?
Not yet. Not in this stage of life.
Okay, so y'all don't go on dates, but let's say you did, you go to a restaurant, something like that. I'm trying to think of something else. Like, do you cut your own grass? Do you have somebody else cut it? Do you build your own decks? Do you have somebody else build it?
We got somebody else who cuts our yard.
Yep. Okay, so, landscaping. Do you do construction or do you have somebody else do it for you?
probably other people. I wish I was Andy.
Yeah. If your car messes up, do you fix it yourself?
I consult.
Take it somewhere. Everything we just said, and we could keep going, I think for hours, are tables that we've started.
Mm.
We've started coffee shops, restaurants, I could name them. We've started mechanic shops. We've started barber shops. Our homes are probably the bread and butter of every movement that we've helped cultivate. We feel like the most kind of quote unquote table setting for my wife and I happens out of our home because we have 5 children. And we just, everywhere we go, we tend to be like a magnet for people who don't typically have a table to sit at. That usually looks like single mothers, brothers and sisters living outside, living on the streets, and fatherless kids usually find their way to our home pretty often. And then that kind of spreads throughout our communities. So that's a huge table, are the homes. Social spaces like gyms. We've started multiple gyms, community centers. We started a large kind of community center we call the Cultural Center in Birmingham, Alabama, with mentoring and education. And my point is a lot of times people, all right, so what, you remember the second A of those 3 A's, the archaeology? The second A might be the most important part of this conversation, which is artistry. When I was in college, I did music and songwriting for years, and I took songwriting courses actually as part of my major in college. And the professors that impacted me the most taught me virtually nothing about how to write a hit song. What they taught me were these elements or these nuances of what made a great song. Things like authenticity, passion, real life experience, hurt, pain, fluidity of contextualization. Like I'm a more of an Americana type songwriter, kind of singer songwriter. So if I added a ton of Latin and hip hop elements to my songwriting, they just wouldn't fit. So contextualization to your style, to your audience, fluidity, things like that. I was able to take those elements and then apply them to my artistry. There were other songwriters in my kind of element, young men and women, who really were just looking for the paint by number. They wanted a hit song. They wanted to be on the radio. So they wanted to know how to listen to the right artist, let's say the Taylor Swifts of the day. I think she's better than people think, but let's just say that they wanted to hear like the elements of just a way to get a song, a 3 minute and 15 second song, 1-4-5-6 chord structure on the radio, verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, and we're good. I feel like far too many men and women in our sphere are looking for that, Tony. They're looking for the paint by number. They want to know, what do I do that will work in my context? And John and myself and Hugh and many others, I would assume you, we're so not interested in telling them how to write a hit song. What we want to give them are the nuances of the kingdom, things like anonymity. We talk about this a lot. Things like decentralization and distribution, things like levity and suffering. If you don't learn to have levity and suffering, then you're going to die by year 7, I guarantee you. So these are the types of things that we talk about, generosity in your ecosystem. But when you want to know what the tables look like, if you think through a 7-day week, you will know what the tables look like. They're contextualized spaces that the Spirit of God are kind of leading artists to architect and to kind of formulate for their context, so that seekers, when they sit at them, they know this is a place where good news is happening. I want to come back here. I feel welcome here. I want to eat here. I want to work out here. I want to get a bike from here. And even if it's not the best, Like, that's never a kingdom nuance. Be the absolute best. In fact, I would say that's virtually impossible because you're concerned about the least.
Mm.
And in a dog-eat-dog world, you can't be concerned about the least if you want to be the best. You have to only be concerned about the best. Mm-hmm. But you want to be great? Sure. You want to put forward a great product, but not at the expense of, you know, we have a guy who comes in one of our restaurants about four times a week, and we have to ban him at least once a month. But it's kind of like, it's kind of like the old drunk from the Andy Griffith show. Like, we ban him, but we know he knows he's welcome back in a week. He just came in and he was tweaking and he was a little unkempt and act in ways that he shouldn't with some of the guests. And so we got to go, dude, you got to bail. You know, you're grounded for a week. You're banned for a week, but we'll see you in a week. And that you're never going to be the best restaurant if you have guys like that coming in regularly. But that's who's always welcome in our spaces.
You know, there's a line in which I highly recommend, if I didn't say this last time, Dorothy Sayers' essay, Why Work, I think is a really like substantial one for me. But she actually says in it, like, something like asking the question, is it good, over what does it pay? And I, for some reason, I just, as Taylor was talking through that, like, you can't be the best if you care about the least. I think like there is a way to, you prioritize good, as in goodness, neighborliness, kingdom ethic, over performance, excellence, market, capturing a certain market share. Those things are peripheral, because again, survival is not your top priority, but kingdom, seek first the kingdom.
Yep. They're on the list, right? But they're just, they're,
well, we pay attention to it. Yeah. We look at our books. We try to make the sales. We need to keep the doors open for sure.
Yep.
But that's just stewardship.
And you know, here's another thing, man, people, this is another conversation, but people will say all the time, like, don't you want to get where you can pay just as much as the best organization in the world? And honestly, like, it's not even a thought. I don't know. Do you want to be the healthiest human being in the world? Like, I don't even think that way. Go work for them. Like, that's not even on our radar. The question is it good over what it does it pay? The question is not, if it's good, you shouldn't get paid anything. That's nonsense. Mm-hmm. The question is, or the thought is there's a priority list and we're holding to that priority list. If the top of your priority list is the amount of money that you make, there are so many organizations to go and work for. Be our guest. Go work for them.
Yeah.
I think the reason why, you know, a question like, you know, going back to the analogy of like song and songwriting and like the theory behind these things. I mean, I love kind of the 30,000 foot view, the philosophical approach, and the, let's kind of talk about the merits of this thing over that thing, or the question altogether. Let's talk about the merits of the question. Like, I love all of that. I think if anything, it's like, so you can have the conversation and you can go kind of around the ideas of it, but then someone's like, okay, but I still have a hard time picturing what that actually looks like. And so you need to hold up a song as an example and say, look, this is how all this stuff plays out in this song. Not to say that this is, you should replicate this song, because really, how many people can do Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen? I don't know how many, but it's an example of a song. And so it's kind of, if so, for the listener, and maybe like our, you know, to us, it's just, we have an aversion to it. But for the listener, even as we're kind of going into, okay, this is what it kind of looks like for this well-built city, or what it looks like in Alton, it's not that this is prescriptive of what your kingdom ecosystems should look like, as much as, if this is the question, if Revelation 18 is like this big thing, and these are some of the concepts that unfold around that, then maybe this is what it has demonstrated itself to look like in our particular context. And you have to figure out in your own context, as the spirit leads you, what does that look like in your life and in your city? And so, man, that's, I'm, like I said, I'm appreciative of you guys for so many reasons, but I do think, you know, one of the things and part of why you make us and me a better Christian is because you do force me to kind of recalibrate, to like not get pigeonholed here, but to step back and look at the whole thing, the whole undergirding, I don't know, the scaffolding that builds that particular thing. And so I am always appreciative of you all. And so I will say, you know, if you're listening to this and you're wondering, man, this is so thought-provoking, I'm curious, because there are so many things to unpack here, like how long it takes you to build these things and the things that you learn and how do you pivot and all that, like, which I'm sure there's lots of things to be said. And even just the little bit of stories that we have here, Brave Cities, it's coming out. Do you guys, I know it's eventually coming out from what I last heard. I don't know if there's any clarity since then.
Yeah, it just seems that Hugh and I in particular need a lot of editing. So, it's been in the editing process now for, gosh, I want to say 2 months, really hardcore for the past month. And then the launch date is first of the year, February, March time. And, John and I and Hugh and some others, kind of small group of us, we're trying to build a little ecosystem together of how we can help other artists, other pioneers plant things like this in their context.
Yeah, for sure. Well, guys, thank you so much for being on this podcast. Always appreciate having you here. And this has been Microchurches. Until next time.